Hey guys, Brad here. I wanted to share a couple things with you before we got started on this episode. First thing is I want to say thank you. Thank you to every single one of you who take time out of your day to listen to us and interact with us, hopefully, and give us an opportunity to be honest with you. Second, after listening to the last episode on white privilege, we decided that we just had more to talk about with this subject, so we decided to make a follow-up episode, and that's what this is. By no means do any of the three of us think that we are experts on this subject. We have done our own research, come together, we're talking about it today, but we would encourage each and every one of you to do your own research and figure out where you're at with this subject. If you're looking for resources, one resource is a guy named Tim Wise. He has done extensive research for over 30 years on this subject, and he has YouTube videos that you can watch. He has articles that he's written. He has books that he's written. One book is called White Like Me. It's a terrific read. So as we get going in this episode, we just wanted to help start a conversation. Feel free to reach out to us and give your opinion on this subject. We'd love to hear from you. But without further ado, let's go ahead and get started on this episode about white privilege.
Man, I hope our levels are great. My heart's great right now. I know that.
That's good.
It's just so good. Hey, Brad, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing good. We finally got storms out of here. They're all coming your way now, but...
It's true.
We got them out of here.
It's true. Those tornadoes, man.
When's that supposed to get here?
It looks like something's about to happen outside pretty soon.
Later today, y'all are supposed to get it, I think, but...
Great.
Yeah, man. We've been crazy. And then I get to go back to New Jersey.
You know what? I think we should have a pretty strong contingent of listeners in New Jersey. So to my New Jersey listeners out there, we're winking at you. We're winking at you right now.
Should we just pick random places and say things that we say are specifically for them?
Yeah.
I'll go with... Just in hopes that posthumously they kind of jump in.
After they die?
Yeah.
All right, so
maybe after this dies.
Yeah, which right now I'm just feeling really confident about it, but ask me in a couple of weeks and we'll see. Brad and I both have connections with New Jersey, right? Like, Brad, how often do you go to New Jersey? It seems like you're there every other week now.
Well, lately I've been there, gosh, I was there 4 weeks straight. I mean, I wasn't there all week for 4 weeks, but I was there pretty close.
Like, you could start rooting for basically anything associated with New Jersey and people aren't going to question it. Like, you're spending a nice chunk of time in there.
Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with the Princeton area now. Like, I know my way around Princeton.
There's our Princeton shout out right there. Shout out to our Princeton listeners. I'm sure you're learning something. I know it's hard to get into that school and you probably have a lot of money, but hey, we're really thankful that you're listening right now. So,
but we do not, and we're impressed.
I've heard of you before.
I've heard of you. Sometimes people say the word Princeton.
That's all I had to add.
That was very good. No, I lived in South Orange for a summer and worked at Seton Hall, so I'll shout out to our Seton Hall listeners. I'm sure there's quite a few.
Where Charlie Hall used to play, right? Mighty Ducks, shout out.
Hey, there you go.
Mighty Ducks 3, good movie.
Yeah, Brad and I are both like, yeah, that movie. I have no memory whatsoever of Mighty Ducks 3.
Don't worry, I do.
Okay, good. Thank you for that.
Is 3 the one where they're at the Olympics?
No. 2 that go to the Olympics. 3 is when they're in college at Seton Hall.
That's beautiful. You know what else is beautiful is that you're eating donuts right now.
Donut holes?
Donut holes.
Come on.
With a really loud paper bag within about 8 inches of the mic, and I'm sure everyone hears that currently.
I'm combating nausea.
Yeah, they're... We'll also say thanks, Shipley's Donuts, for sponsoring us this morning with your delicious donut holes
once
in
again,
Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
They're going to go back in time and sponsor us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's how it works. So we're here. This podcast is called Everything is Okay. I was thinking back this week, we don't really reiterate what Everything is Okay is all about as much as maybe we could. So for new listeners, and I'm going to assume that there are some new listeners, what does Everything Okay stand for? Why are we called that?
Assuming since you looked at me, you want me to answer that.
I mean, you can, or Brad can. Someone should, though, probably.
Well, we all met in Oklahoma and grew up there. And so when we were talking about doing a podcast, we were thinking we could have interesting content and talk to a lot of people that we grew up around and knew from Oklahoma and have a lot of diversity in the podcast even. And viewpoints and all that sort of thing without actually leaving people we knew from Oklahoma. So we call it Everything is Okay. And then...
So it's kind of a play on words a little bit.
It is, but then not very many episodes in, we had people that are not from Oklahoma on.
Right, but the fun thing about it is, regardless of who's on this podcast, we are still from Oklahoma. So I think we win.
It's true.
I think we win there. I think we hold on to the premise of it.
Plus, I think we still think everything will be okay.
Most of the time.
Most of the time.
We try to.
I mean, I'd like to. I'd like to believe that I'm not just doomed.
I think it takes down our blood pressure a little bit.
As you chug a monster.
Yeah, as my heart dies slowly.
Are you feeling heart palpitations right now, Brad?
No, but I have before. Not from this, but
Are you sure?
At one point when I was studying for my master's, I had to stay up all night because I procrastinated and I had to get something done before 8 o'clock that morning. So I stayed up and I took 2 5-hour energies, but I took them too close together. And for about 30 minutes, I thought I was needing to go to the hospital. I was shaking, like physically shaking. I couldn't get my hand to stop. And I like laid on my couch in the fetal position for a little bit because I thought I was about to die. So
that's terrifying.
Don't do that.
So 5-Hour Energy is not a sponsor, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we just lost their sponsorship as well.
No. Thanks, Brad. Take 5-Hour Energy. Don't take two within five hours.
Right. Yeah. Right. Don't double the fun.
I love 5-Hour Energy, especially on road trips, but don't take too many of them. It'll make you feel like you want to die.
Yeah.
And feeling like you're going to die is worse than that 3:30 feeling. Isn't that what they say?
I think so.
In the commercials. Isn't that the time?
You know that 3:30 feeling.
Yeah.
God, you're so droggy. You just went to Raising Cane's and had a lot of chicken fingers. Is it 3:30 p.m. or 3:30 a.m.?
P.m.
Okay, good. I'll keep going with this.
It's p.m. because I think it's supposed to be during the workday.
I just think
that their company decided to have a campaign against a certain time of day. And I feel like they are the only the only thing that has ever campaigned against a certain type of time of day. And just the general feeling of that time of day, even.
I hope our listeners reach out and let us know if there's been any other marketing campaigns that have either supported or hated on a specific time of day. And let us know, because that would be really interesting.
Watch, we're probably off on the time. And we just talked for a while about how 3:30 is terrible. It's
whatever. We'll be all right. So our last episode was on white privilege. And we got a lot of feedback on that episode, which I was excited about. Old Phil Butler, man.
Yeah, so in the last episode, we introduced the idea of white privilege, kind of gave a brief introduction, I guess.
Right, but there's more to say, man. There's more to say.
And we decided to do a follow-up episode to get a little bit more in-depth into what we're referring to and all that. So,
yeah, so the first thing I wanted to hit on is we did a really good job of talking about what we're not trying to say on the last episode. I want to throw out just a quick generic definition of what white privilege is. It's an unearned, and this is key, unearned societal privilege or benefit beyond what non-white folks who are at a very similar level with you, so like from an economic standpoint, from an educational standpoint, etc., experience from a societal standpoint. So this is coming from a sociology perspective. I think what makes this difficult even recently is that this concept has a lot of like political firepower associated with it. And that's happened fairly recently, pretty aggressively, right? So you're seeing this kind of a left tent or, you know, a liberal tent associated with identity politics, et cetera. And so this has kind of jumped into this. But what's interesting about it is it's this concept in the literature has been around for decades. And it's just, I don't know, it's getting a lot of press. So just wanted to define specifically what we're talking about from a white privilege standpoint.
Cool. One of the first things we wanted to do is David, you've had a pretty intimate, I guess, walk into this subject. This got introduced to you in college by Phil. One of the things you mentioned is that you have actually done something that I had actually never heard of until this week, but you did something called a privilege walk. Do you want to kind of expand on that?
And I think Phil and I referenced it a little bit in the interview, but I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about what I experienced in it and why it was important. So this was actually in grad school. And so like I'd heard a little bit about white privilege at Southern Miss through some of my education, but I hadn't really thought extensively about it. And a lot of the reactions that I had personally was like, I was angry, I was frustrated, I was in denial, because I was like, what are you talking about? Because it just wasn't ringing true to me. And a lot of that has to do with how invisible this concept is to people who have unearned, almost invisible privilege. And I'm one of those people. So the privilege walk, the idea basically behind it is that you are in a room with lots of different people that may look like you, may not look like you, all have different backgrounds. So some people may be come from wealthier families, some people come from poor families, some people may be white, some people may be Asian, black, etc. Some people may be straight, some people may be gay. And it's all of these different identity intersections. Some people may be able-bodied, some people may not be. And they start throwing out these different questions. And if a question like lines up for you, then you would take a step forward and you get to like visually see where you are on a privilege scale. So this is much more all-encompassing than just your race, right? Which I think is extremely important for people who have many different intersections or different experiences as a white person. So like I came from a upper middle class background, and I assumed growing up because of my circles for the most part that like I'm normal, quote unquote. And so like doing an activity like this and having it painfully obvious that you're extremely privileged around other people who have a little bit different experience than you, like made it come true to me. So like, let me give an example. So one of the questions that they may ask is, your primary ethnic identity is American. So for me, that was 100% true. Like I identify as American. So I stepped forward. A lot of people of color, not white, didn't do that. Another one would be, if you've ever been called names because of your race, class, ethnicity, gender, or sexual orientation. So for me, I didn't step forward in that example because I had been made fun of because of my super pasty white skin or my freckles or whatever. But that example, a lot of people who are white and extremely privileged may have stepped forward, been like, no, I don't really get made fun of for my race that much, or I'm straight, so I haven't been made fun of for being straight that much. So that's another example. Another question is like, your parents are educated professionals. So for me, I was like, well, my mom stayed at home, but she went to college. And yeah, my dad's an educated professional. So I had to step forward, but there were other people in the room that didn't on that question. Some people did, some people didn't. And so as it goes on and on, I realized I'm in this room with like at least 20 people. And I was the person in the very, very front. And it was extremely eye-opening for me. It was embarrassing. It was frustrating because I hadn't, until that moment, I hadn't literally stopped and thought at length, looking behind me at all of these other people who I saw as equals, realizing that like their experience was a little bit different than mine. And I think part of understanding, we hear this privilege word or this white privilege word or phrase, is understanding that like it's invisible to people who experience high levels of privilege. And so for me personally, I experienced very, very high levels of privilege and had no idea, or I did know maybe intellectually, but I didn't really feel it. It was shattering to see it around other peers. So
what made you feel embarrassed by being towards the front of that?
Yeah, I think one of the things was realizing that everybody was looking at me. So I was in a room full of a lot of college students. I was a graduate student there. So I was supposed to be, I'm in a position of like almost authority per se, right? Like I'm like a student mentor or whatever. Looking back, it sucks to be alone, you know? Like I was like, man, it's just me up here. And then I looked back and I was like, there were one or two students who were way farther back than kind of an average of the students there as well. And I was like, God, that's got to suck too, you know? And understanding again that like my whole life, I have assumed that I've realized that I'm quote unquote blessed, but I'm like, I have two parents that are married. My mom stays at home. I knew that my dad had a job that probably made more money than some people, but I never considered us rich. Like we never talked about that because we weren't rich in my mind. Again, because I knew that there were many, many, many other people that had a lot more money. It feels uncomfortable to be at the front alone, okay? When you think that there should be other people up there with you. And when it's like super apparent and super obvious in an activity, it hits home. And I'm a visual learner, like visually seeing that was extremely helpful for me realizing, I guess I did have a couple positives or steps forward that I didn't earn that put me in this position that I'm in. Because I would say like much like other quote unquote Americans, aka the majority of my friends growing up, we knew that if we worked hard and we did all the right things, we would be successful. You know, like that's what we've been taught. We're like, we're smart, you're capable, work hard, get educated, and everything's going to work itself out. And so naturally, I felt like I'd earned everything that I'd gotten. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, for some, I know I've worked hard and, you know, we've worked hard to advance once I started working. But I get what you're saying in that there are things that we don't have to experience. There's hurdles that we don't have to jump over, right? Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Well, it was just painfully apparent at that moment that not everybody's experience is the same as mine. Like that's kind of what I'm saying. And I feel like this whole privilege conversation of these different identities that may intersect or whatever, it's not about feeling bad or terrible about what you have not earned or what you experience. It just helps from an awareness standpoint to realize like, okay, I've been told for a long, long time that everybody's equal. And in the United States, it's not true. and that was extremely painful to see and to kind of like mentally go through, because that's like, that's your worldview, right? We're taught from TV, from parents, from friends, from family, from movies, etc. Like we are taught that there's an American dream and that everybody can equally get there. All you have to do is work hard. You have to put your boots on, you know, and do what you need to do. And that's that. And like everybody works hard. And that's kind of what I had internalized. So,
right. And I do actually like that view of being able to discuss privilege more than what I hear mentioned a lot, because I'm really tempted to push back against the term privilege often when things that I hear brought up a lot are white privilege is being able to go into a store and not be followed like you're going to steal something, or getting pulled over by the police, you don't have to worry about getting shot, or being able to get a loan at a bank. Things that I don't think should ever be considered privilege. That should be the baseline of humanity. Like, if we look at those things as privilege, we're already wrong in a base standpoint, you know? So I've always been very frustrated with that idea of white privilege, and like, no, everyone should have that. That needs to be the norm. But when you go into things like your parents staying together, yes, it would be great if everybody's parents could stay together in a healthy relationship, but that's just not realistic that that's going to happen. And so that's something that I can accept more as privilege.
I think we get stuck on the terminology. You know, we hear the word privilege, and again, like James is making the point, and rightfully so, like that should be the norm for everybody, right? Am I hearing you right on that?
Well, lots of the things I hear referenced often, but yeah, there's definitely other things that aren't going to be the norm for everybody, and that's okay.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's tough to come to the realization is that, like, the being a white guy and those examples of, like, knowing that I'm not going to get shot unless, you know, odds are I'm not getting shot if I get pulled over, for example. Odds are I'm not getting chased. I'm not getting followed in a store because the store owners assume that I'm not going to steal anything. Those things are categorized as white privilege in this language. The tough thing about it is that there's this, like, invisible bias that's happening where people of color may not experience the same things on average that white people do. And from everything that I've heard from conversations that I've had and looking into the literature, is like they just don't. Like, it's a very different experience in the United States. It just is. And that's a problem. And I think we can all agree, the three of us, that is a problem. And it's unearned. Like, again, it's an unearned treatment that for some reason in the United States, white people get versus people that don't look like us.
I agree that we can agree that there are races who have it worse. I'm not trying to say that. I'm more saying that I feel like there should be a baseline of the way humanity is treated, and white people start on that line. And sadly, there's a lot of white people that are above that line making decisions to make sure that people of color stay below that line. I'm just saying that more than making it seem like there's a pedestal that all white people are on, it's more of like, this is the way all people should be treated, and other people are being held down. It's not that white people are being lifted up from what should be normal. It's that other people are being held down from what should be normal, which I get is a subtle difference, but it means a lot in my head and understanding of this to be able to say, like, the people who are on this baseline, it's not that they're doing something to hold the other people down necessarily, but you do need to be aware that there are people or institutions, systems that are holding people down. And so we need to work to remove those hurdles, whatever, remove anything that keeps people from being able to start on that baseline of humanity.
Right. And I think that it's tough because that baseline of humanity you're talking about is, it's where white people are naturally. And I think that's the invisible bias or invisible privilege, quote unquote, that we are the baseline. And unfortunately, not everybody has a seat at that table. And if we were talking to any person of colors and we asked them, are you experiencing the same things that we are? And using those examples, et cetera. Like, every person that I've talked to, they have a specific example, which is, it's very strange that there's that many examples of being treated differently. For instance, using the example of in a store, for it to be, I don't know, it seems like it's rampant, you know, which is tough.
Hey guys, I just wanted to check up on everybody, make sure everybody was still with us. I also wanted to kind of give you a little bit more information about the Privilege Walk, if that was something that piqued your interest. David talked a lot about it and gave a lot of information about it, but I wanted to give you just a little bit more. Looking on the internet, I found a module that was released by the University of Albany. They have a pretty good purpose for the privilege walk that I wanted to share with you. And in their module, it says, "The purpose of the privilege walk activity is to learn to recognize how power and privilege can affect our lives even when we are not aware it is happening. The purpose is not to blame anyone for having more power or privilege or for receiving more help and achieving goals, but to have an opportunity to identify both obstacles and benefits experienced in our life." They also have, I would call it, a word of warning for an activity such as this. They note that this is a very high-risk activity that requires trust building and safety for all participants. I think that's very important when we start talking about these type of topics. Trust and safety is high on the list of what needs to happen when you decide to go through activities of this nature. To give you an example of what type of questions would be asked of the participants, here's a few that they list out. One is, if you are a white male, take one step forward. Another is, if you have visible or invisible disabilities, take one step backward. Another is, if your family had health insurance, take one step forward. And finally, another one is, if you feel good about how your identified culture is portrayed by the media, take one step forward. So that gives you an idea kind of what the privilege walk is all about. Now let's get back to mine and David and James's talk. Was the privilege walk kind of the first introduction to this that you received?
It wasn't the first introduction. It was just the first time that I'd been around non-white people. Basically, I was around people that had different experiences than I did. Like, it was just, again, it was painfully obvious that, like, I was much farther down the scale than everybody else in the room that was doing the activity. And so, again, it's shocking, you know? And it's when I think back of, like, my upbringing and the circles that I was in Claremore, Oklahoma, et cetera, like, there's a lot of homogeny in that, which is, I'm not hating on that. I didn't have much of a multicultural education or experience growing up. Like, I had a lot of white friends, majority white friends. It's not that I didn't have other friends that weren't white, but the majority were white.
The line that I have always, if anybody's ever asked me this, or if I've ever been in a conversation, the line I always will say about Claremore is, when we were growing up, we didn't have a lot of racial tension, but we didn't have a lot of racial diversity.
See, yeah. And I wonder if the question, did you have racial tension in your town growing up, would be answered differently if you weren't white.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
I know that there was basically a section of town that people didn't go, like in the middle of town, really, where that was where most of the black people lived.
Yeah. That's a good point. And for me too, it's one of the tough things for white people in general is, again, just having this conversation, because we didn't have to have the conversation, you know? like when we were growing up, I have no memory whatsoever of me sitting down and having like a critical conversation about my whiteness ever. And I think that's a big piece of this, is that that's part of the quote-unquote privilege of being in a position of the majority, is that we're American, right? Like, that's at least what I was taught growing up, and that's what I took in, you know?
Yeah, and because I've not been aware of it while in, or not sought it out, I guess, while in Claremore, I don't know what, I can't speak to more than just knowing there was a general area that most of black people lived. But I do know, more recently, I lived in a town in Florida, and I would say people there would also say there wasn't racial tension. Well, white people would, but just off of Main Street, like the Main Street going down the middle of the town, it wasn't a huge town. It was a little smaller than Claremore, probably, but a street over, back from the main street was where most black people lived, and the ghetto area was there, like government housing, all of that kind of stuff, the stuff that people who knew of it would reference as kind of the ghetto. I had a lot of friends out there, and I would go and hang out with people over in that area, and definitely noticed that the police wouldn't go in to those neighborhoods, but patrolled the outside of it constantly. There was always multiple cop cars driving around the outside. There was an obvious division of, we will watch you if you go into our territory, which was the town.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
When I would mention to people about that whole section of the town where a huge percentage of the town actually lived, people didn't know it existed because they didn't have to. It was a street away from where they were at all the time, and most white people didn't even know it was there.
So this didn't just obviously happen. This isn't something that's like just now people are starting to realize, oh my gosh, there's the division. Like, this has been, there's a history of things that have allowed for this. Is gap the right word?
That, guys, we are not experts. We're just trying here. So I'll throw that out there.
Yeah. So there's an obvious history of things that have happened that have allowed for this gap to happen. And so you can't really have a conversation about this without looking at the history and seeing where this came from, right? The obvious era in the United States is slavery, right? People being brought over here to do labor for the white Southerners, right? That's an obvious thing. But then when you start to talk about, well, you have the Civil War, you have the 13th Amendment. But if you've ever watched the documentary on Netflix, 13th, which is an amazing documentary if people haven't seen it, they go on about, in the 13th Amendment, there was a clause that was just thrown into the 13th Amendment that says, I'm paraphrasing here, but all people are free except for punishment for crime.
I think it was for labor, basically.
Right. No person is forcibly...
Yeah, can be forced to do labor for free or something like that.
Unless they commit a crime.
Exactly. So,
right.
Unless they commit a crime. So what began to happen is people would start to find reasons to throw the black community in jail. They would find things, loitering, you know, whatever, and they would start to throw them in jail. And then all of a sudden, now they're back to working for the same.
That's weird, because that sounds like today. What year are you talking about? What era was this?
Hey guys, I promise it's the last time that I'll break in, but while we were recording this and when I started talking about history, I just inexplicably stopped talking. Then we got to talking about something else, and we never really came back. James and David, in a second, will do a really good job of doing a recap of what we were talking about, but I wanted to encourage you guys to do your own research when it comes to this subject. A good place to start is just the Netflix documentary 13th. They do a tremendous job of going through history and showing what has happened since the 13th Amendment was ratified to end slavery. But with that, we'll go ahead and get right back into it.
Well, let's talk about some of the history. Just in kind of a broad, sweeping generalization, yes, there was slavery. That's how a lot of the black community that was here for a long time, that's how they got here, was through slavery. And then when slavery was ended, there was a backlash on that there was the KKK, which was a terrorist organization. Now, think of the fear that people felt on 9/11. That was black life. That was black life. After like that feeling of
like constant
an attack
fear
has happened.
Yeah.
We can be attacked at any time. There's no safety. That's the way the black community felt after the Civil War, because there was the KKK, where they would travel around and just hang people for no real reason. And there was so much violence. There was all of that. And so there was that. And then it goes into that gets better, quote unquote. We move into like segregation time period, and it's you can be here around us. We won't necessarily attack you, but you don't get to use the same stuff as us.
Right.
You have to be apart from us, because you will dirty anything you touch of ours. Like, you have to stay separate. That's your bathroom. We don't want any part of that.
And like, specifically, and Tim Wise talks a little bit about this in some of his YouTube videos, if you want to check it out. White people obviously got preferential treatment for like honors classes and anything that would allow the white community to be still considered excellent, et cetera, in these systems. were still there. So like if there was, and he gives an example in one of his talks about like there was this obviously racist woman who was pissed off at him as a kid because he was hanging out with all the black kids and like connected with them because of, I think he lived in the same neighborhood as they did. Basically, he was really good at reading, but he got like an F or whatever. So his mom came and they found out very quickly that the teacher gave him an F because she didn't like the vernacular that he was using because he wasn't talking like educated white folks are supposed to talk. He wrote correctly, but really she was just pissed off that he was hanging out with these black kids because he was not supposed to. So that's just one example of some things that happened back then.
There's also someone in town that we actually know in Mississippi. He was in one of the first schools around here that had been desegregated. Like during the time period where they were desegregating the schools, he was going to be valedictorian for his high school. And so they graduated him early so they wouldn't have a black valedictorian.
See, that's the sort of things that happen. And like, what decade was that? Was that the 60s? I mean, not to put you on the spot, but it was like 50s, 60s, something like that. This is not 100 years ago. And I think it's tough because we want to, in 2017, think that like the past isn't affecting our current state, right? Like our current status, and that we're progressive and that we're beyond this sort of thing, and that like when you turn on the TV, like it seems extremely multicultural, right? But unfortunately, some of these systems are still in existence. And then the other piece that I think was really clear to me when I was doing the privilege walk again, and this is not every white person doesn't have a long line of wealth that's helped them out or whatever, but there is a large percentage that do. And like, that's a piece, like when you're talking about being at the same line. When I go back in history from my dad to his grandpa to his great grandpa, etc., I can't tell you when they didn't own property. Now, that is not the specific example for every white person in America, obviously. If you were Italian, if you were Irish, etc., many of them were considered the minority for an extended period of time as well. That's why I think that so many people find this topic itself very frustrating, because it seems like every white person gets thrown into a category of you're privileged, you know? And it's the privilege walk, I think, pulling it back helped me realize that it's very stratified. There's an intersection of how wealthy you are, you know, et cetera, that play into this, right? So like a white person who's poor is not going to have the same amount of privilege as a white person who's middle class or as a white person who's wealthy. And if you were white and your jobs are gone, et cetera, or you feel like your industry is disappearing, like coal miners, for example, it's almost like you've been given this truth of you will excel because of who you are. Then you grow up and then that industry disappears and you look around for somebody to blame it on, right? And so you're naturally going to blame it on somebody who's quote unquote taking your jobs, et cetera. And you can tell that there's like this huge disappointment with what they've been sold, right? You know, it's understandable. And I don't know.
You know, you mentioned 9/11, and one of the videos I watched from Tim Wise, he mentions 9/11 specifically. And he talks about how after 9/11, if you were to watch people on television interviews, the only people who were saying things such as, I don't understand why they hate us so much, and I don't understand why they would attack us, and I don't understand why they hate our way of life, was white people. No other race was saying that type of thing.
Which is crazy to me to think about, because I didn't notice, like that's not something I would have noticed.
After hearing him say that, looking back, and I remember you would hear that all the time. It was an attack on our way of life. They hate democracy. They hate freedom. They hate our country because we offer the most to our people. It's true. Our country does have a lot of amazing things that it offers. But I think what we're saying is privilege says they hate us because we're free, because we just identify as our country. Whereas if we were other races, they'd be like, well, I know what it's like to be hated just because of something
right
as arbitrary as skin color. Or I know what it's like to be hated because, I don't know, because
I'm poor, Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Take it past race and just say poor.
Right.
You know, criminal justice system is totally in favor of wealthy over poor. That's documented, you know, 1,000 times over.
Yeah. Do a Netflix search on that one. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, even the fact that when 9/11 happened, there was all this discussion on it being like the biggest terrorist attack and one of like the first terrorist attacks on American soil kind of thing, when that was for white people.
Yeah.
But I mean, we came and basically used diseases to wipe out Indians. Or murdered them.
Yeah.
Or
if you're looking for more
took their weapons and then shot them.
Yeah.
Or burned churches full of black people. Or would hunt them down and hang them. Anyone who is not white, they've had a history of terrorism against them in this country, perpetuated by white people. Mm-hmm. It's essentially a slap in the face to the history of America to say things about how like we've just started having terrorist issues, because it shows some of this fragility that we had talked about before.
Right.
And
white
that,
fragility.
And the fact that we just don't understand, this is the worst thing ever. We have to do something about this. And realistically, not trying to downplay 9/11 at all, but not that many people died. Way more than should have. It should have never happened. It's a tragedy, but not that many people happened, and it was essentially one attack happened, and we've been at war for years, like over a decade.
Right, and but it'd
there
be
was, there was
and again,
decades of stuff happening.
Right,
and we still don't talk too much about it.
Yeah, and it's one of those things again. Like if you're anti-American, if you even remotely downplay 9/11, because it was terrible. It was absolutely a ridiculous tragedy. And we all, I bet you the three of us remember exactly where we were when it happened. Like, it was scarring. How about the Oklahoma City bombing?
Yeah.
Let's go back another decade. Who was that terrorist? You know, like, this example, like, it's tough, man. It's super tough.
There's actually a new documentary out about the Oklahoma City bombing.
I know, I want to see it. I want to see it.
It's on Netflix. It's great. Where they explore the history before Timothy McVeigh was ever even in the picture, where they talk about from the 80s with, you know, up in, I think it was like Montana or something, with basically white nationalist groups.
Right.
And how they were forming and how they would shape the narrative of what would happen. There was an incident, I don't remember the man's name, there was an incident up in the mountains where the FBI raided this guy's house. He walks out with a gun, guns a-blazing. FBI shoots, his wife gets killed. Narrative in the white nationalist papers basically said FBI's against us.
Right.
It all was shaped, and it all culminated essentially into Timothy McVeigh and Oklahoma City, because he saw things like Waco and he saw all of these things and would read these papers and see the narrative that was being presented to him and
enacted on it
in an obviously major way.
Yeah, it's jarring when you step back and you think about what you're talking about with 9/11. It obviously affected Americans, and the lens that we as white Americans saw it naturally versus the way that people of color may have saw that narrative, and the fact that we have, for the most part, I can talk about me individually. I don't have a history of disappointment or a history of being profiled, etc. And so when something terrible or jarring happens, it has a huge impact on, I think, on the white population in a way that maybe it doesn't have on other populations that are in positions of minority power versus majority power.
One thing I would say for kind of my history is, and for a lot of people's history, is my grandparents, both my grandfathers, were in World War II. One was in the Army, one was in the Navy. And things that happened to them there, things that came from that changed their mindsets, work ethic, what they were able to do financially when they came back. Lots of things were affected by that I'm sure if we wanted to work down the line, we could say there's a lot of things that happened from my grandparents that are the reason why I'm able to be where I'm at right now. If you look at that same time frame, what has happened in Black culture? I mean, my mom was in Hot Springs when Arkansas was the first state to have desegregation and when the army had to be sent in for that to happen.
Right.
That was in my parents' generation. And so if traumatic events and something that was a big deal for, you know, a matter of years shaped things about my grandparents enough that it affects me now, like what in, like we can't say that segregation and still having Klan activity and people being hung and that sort of thing within the past two generations
has been eradicated.
Does not still have a big impact on where culture is now. We aren't saying that nothing has gotten better.
Because it definitely has.
We are saying it's not fixed. The problem is if we feel like it's fixed and stop moving forward, we will move backward.
Yeah, and I love that example, I think, shines light on the term that you may hear of like internalized racism, in the sense that like we are socialized as individuals, it doesn't matter who you are, from a very, very early age. Like, for instance, I have memories of different family members using like racial slurs at different points in my life as a kid that were obviously not my parents' generation, but older family members, right? Because those were terms that were used openly not too long ago. And this internalized racism, I feel like it comes from not just family members, it comes from everyone that we interact with when we watch TV, when we see that, like, I mean, obviously if you see a bad guy on, I don't know, name a crime show, they may be white, but odds are it's probably a Black guy, you know? It's like it's different things, like it's different narratives that are happening or occurring that we invisibly take in, right? Like we soak all of this in.
More recently, if you look at 24, they are all basically Islamic terrorists from some other country,
yep.
Right?
That narrative sells, right? Like that's what we're soaking in.
Well, I think that's an important point to make, is narrative and what narrative is shaping, you know, different groups of people. Even if you just look at politics, and you hear people talk about this all the time, depending on what cable news show you watch, then that will shape what you feel about the exact same event. And I remember during the election, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal, and they sent out the exact same event, exact same story, two different headlines depending on where it was going in the country. And what area and what side those people were on.
Right. What's going to sell? What do people want to read?
Right.
Yeah.
It's real easy to get yourself caught into a pattern where you only hear one narrative. And so in that narrative, you become very confident that this is the only narrative being presented to everybody.
Yeah.
And that is a dangerous place to be, because at that point, you've now assumed that everyone is on the same page.
There's even this idea of America is best, right? That was so deeply ingrained generations ago. America is best.
Yep.
The best country. Everything's better here. When I know for a long time growing up, I felt like America was the only democracy.
Yeah.
The only one. And there's
that's not shocking at all. Yeah.
There's essentially like better forms of voting for it to be more democratic. There's also the fact that we are nowhere near the top in education or racial equality,
healthcare.
Gender equality, yeah. Healthcare. Like so many statistics that you would think would be factors in who's best, we're nowhere near the top. But still, there's this narrative of America is the best. America is the best.
Sure.
Everybody would want to attack us because we're best and they're jealous. That's the narrative, because obviously America is best. So when you have that foundation, America's best, everything is filtered through that, right? So imagine being a people group that for generations were told you are property. You're property, and then you're not property, but you're not equal. You can be around, but you have to have your own thing because you're not allowed to touch ours.
Right.
That's been until very recently. And so there is such an ingrained mental attack that's been done on people of color in this country that we can't just stop doing that and expect it to be fine. There needs to be an active combat of that.
Yeah. Anti-racism. Whoop, whoop. Google that, people.
Yeah. It's horrific, the things that were done until, you know, a generation ago. And in that generation, like not even like before it.
And still terrible things are happening.
Still some terrible things are happening. It is getting better, but we can't, like I said, we can't just stop. You have to actively combat it.
It just now happened in Tulsa 2 days ago. We just had another person get off.
Yeah, the verdict came out. Yep.
And if you were to watch that video, depending on what lens you watch it through.
I'm sorry, I don't know what you're
okay, so there was a police shooting here in Tulsa of Terrence Crutcher probably about 6 months ago. It was right in the heart of all of the police shootings that were happening.
Yeah.
They actually have shown more of the video than I've ever seen. If you were to watch the one of the helicopter, listen to what that guy's saying, because that guy's telling you what their true feelings are right then, because that guy's simply walking away from her. Yes, he was not complying with her commands. I get that. But he's simply walking away from her, and that guy in that chopper says, that guy looks like a bad dude.
Right. And that's internalized, invisible bias. That has been soaked in from socialization, from being a kid.
Right. You can go on YouTube right now. I actually did this a few months ago. You can go on YouTube right now, and there's actually a video of a young kid getting shot by the police officer. It is a kid. He's pulling into a gas station. It's a black teenager. He gets pulled into a gas station. He gets out of the car, which people will tell you that was his mistake, all this stuff, right? However, he gets out of the thing. The cop asks him for his driver's license. He reaches in the car to get his driver's license. Cop shoots him.
Because the cop was terrified,
right?
I'm sure, at that moment, assuming that he was reaching for a gun.
Right. David, when you mentioned there's things that we don't even understand that we wouldn't have to deal with, it's those type of things that I don't think if I was to reach into my car that I would have necessarily been shot immediately.
Right.
But James, you kind of already have segued into this. What is the next step? How does this improve? Because obviously us just talking about it, yes, that's going to help. But
yeah,
what are some things?
Yeah, I think, I mean, talking about it and getting more comfortable talking about it is one of the first steps. For me personally, and I think it helps anybody. Another, I think, active step that we can take is calling out racist comments or homophobic comments or sexist comments, etc., when we hear it around our friends. And then teaching ourselves, if we have that sort of language, to not use that sort of language. So an example for me would, like, I used to say the R word all the time. Because I didn't know, it was just one of the words that we said. Like, instead of stupid, we said the R word. That's a very offensive term. I've worked that word out of my vernacular. So I don't naturally say that anymore because I understand the implications with it. So I think changing language and challenging jokes is just one example of like fighting that narrative.
There's also more than theory is you need to have some skin in the game. Get to know people who are not in your socioeconomic status, who are not your same skin color, whatever. Like, genuinely invite people into your life. Don't have them be your token black friend or anything like that. Have them be a friend. Yeah. Like, legitimately get to know people, because all these stigmas that happen are only things that you can have if you don't know somebody who is gay, who is black, who is a Muslim, who's from any Middle Eastern country, who's, you know, any of these things that right now are not great to be in America. It's hard to have these generalized, all these people are criminals if they're black, sex addicts if they're gay, who just want to rape everybody, who hate all white people and all Americans and want to murder all Americans if they're Muslim. These are legitimate things that I have heard people say on more than one occasion, and I heard on the news for several of them. But you can't hold that view if you actually get to know someone who's in any of those categories, because it's just not true.
I think it can be tough because you can't just develop a couple friendships with people in one of those categories and magically fix all of your internal issues with that. And I think that's something that's a great first step. Absolutely. But trying to actively fight some of that internalized narrative that you may experience or feel is helpful in that as well. Those narratives are reinforced almost on a daily basis. And so like being aware of it, developing relationships, like you said, and then trying to actively fight those narratives, even in yourself, is a great start.
You know, watching, you know, documentaries on some of these issues or reading books about them, just seeing other perspectives is huge. And none of these are the fix. It's nope. All are necessary to be moving Absolutely. Forward. You have to do a whole lot of different things. It's a lot of work. It really is. But for as a nation, for there to be any success and for us not to just crumble into hatred and fear, I feel like we need to pursue this. This is for Absolutely. Personal health, national health, racial health, all of it. This is better for everyone if we make effort.
And understand that this is not going to change overnight.
No.
It's not going to change in a month. It's not going to change in, it's not going to fully change in a year. It's not going to, maybe not even in our lifetime, are we going to fully see things the way we would like to see them.
But we got to fight for it.
It took decades upon decades to get where we are now. So it's going to take a while.
And at least one war.
Yeah.
Sticking to it and not getting discouraged if you lose a friend over bringing something up. If you hear somebody say something and they get mad at you because you say, hey man, I don't want to hear you say that, or whatever. And explain to them why. Don't just say, I don't want to hear you say that. Leave it at that. And then there'd be some weirdness.
Yeah. And the last thing I wanted to say is that Tim Wise, again, used this example that hit me super hard that I heard this week, actually. And he talked about, like, if you asked any woman right now, if having a, like, if a guy who has a relationship with a woman isn't sexist by definition because he has a relationship with a woman, they would probably laugh in your face. And I was like, oh, snap. That's a good point. Like, having relationships with women does not magically make us not sexist. So why do we use that logic with building, like, having individual relationships with different people groups, etc., and that, like, magically fixing any internalized issues that we have? And I think that, like, I can say personally, like, I fight, like, sexism, racism, you name any of those isms, like, because of my socialization in the United States. It's not anything I did or my family did, etc. Like, I still fight some of those stereotypes in my mind. And so when we actively accept that we are going to fight those and then keep fighting those, then that's going to hopefully move us forward as a people group. All right, so if you want more resources on this, we're going to list it on the website, and we're also going to, we'll list it on the actual podcast info when you download it. And so check into those. We need y'all's help. We need as many of y'all who's willing. Please review us, take time, follow us, tell your friends. We do not have hundreds of thousands of dollars to do marketing. And so we need you guys
to
help.
Or sponsors. Come on, Red Bull.
Yeah, we don't have any sponsors. Come on, Red Bull. No. If you would, though, please take time. Follow us on Facebook. So that's facebook.com/everythingisoklahoma. If you search Everything Is Okay, you should find it. I'll put the Twitter handle on it. But probably the easiest thing to do is www.everythingisokay.net. On our website, we have links to every social media page that we have.
Everything.
Our MySpace.
Our Vimeo, all of it.
Dude, we have so many social media websites. No, in all seriousness, though, follow us on Twitter. And we'd love to communicate with you on there or on Facebook. And then you can also, you could even throw questions at us through the website. And we love hearing from our fans, for sure. We love it.
Especially those of you in Japan. Shout out to our Japanese listeners.
That's right. That's right. We're taking over. We're taking over Japan.
We're big in Japan, guys.
We're so big. We're so big in Japan. Strong contingency in Texas, thanks to our episode with Phil Butler. Yeah. We love you guys, though, for real. So again, it's everythingisokay.net. Check it out. And we heard you guys. Did I miss anything?
Probably.
Probably.
I mean, no.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, we nailed it.
I basically feel like we have nothing more to ever say.
Never. We're done. That's going to be it, guys. This is our last podcast.
I think we just decided to end the podcast right now.
I think we're going to end it with the dogs barking. Elliot is such the defender of this house. Like, it's he always has to bark. So
the final moments of this podcast ever will be a solo of Elliot being angry.
Bark, bark, bark. I'm an angry person.
And I like that Brad told us to end this podcast and was pretty confident we would like stay focused and do it.
Yep.
And he could stay out of it. And he's just kind of shaking his head.
Yeah.
Like, I made a mistake by getting this started.
See, ultimately, I have the power because I could just cut you.
That's true.
You do have the power. Man, was that a segue back into our podcast about power dynamics? That was lovely. All right.
I feel like this podcast is going to end with us rambling and Brad saying, you forget I have the power to cut you off, and it's going to just stop.
Oh my gosh. This is great. So I'm David Meggs.
I'm James Eisenhower.
I'm Brad Stair. Everything's okay, people.
Thoughts of farthest fancies come to life as I fade away. What I care about is time advancing. I'm drinking ale today. How I feel my heart starts to sing. taking me home. Too damn bad I'm gonna go there alone.
That really is a theory. It's really wrong, but it is a theory.
Hey, there you go.